Wallace Kleindienst, volunteer reader for Sun Sounds of Arizona, and this is American History. Reading from The 10 Key Campaigns of the American Revolution. We continue to read from Campaign Number 7, the Monmouth, New Jersey Campaign, June 1778, Tactical Draw, Political Victory. It's now the summer of 1778, and the British Army has vacated Philadelphia on its move back to New York City. George Washington and his army are in pursuit of the British Army. That army, led by General Clinton, is aiming for Monmouth, New Jersey, and then up to Sandy Hook in order to cross over to New York City by boat. It's June 25th, 1778. While General Clinton moved deeper into New Jersey, George Washington pondered his next move. By the 24th of June, the Americans had reached Hopewell, New Jersey. Barely 20 miles now separated the armies. Learning of Clinton's move towards Freehold, George Washington considered striking at least part of the retreating enemy. Another council of war, however, revealed little consensus among his generals. The Hawks argued for hitting General Clinton hard, although without precipitating a general engagement, that is, without committing the entire American Continental Army. If we want to suffer the enemy to pass through New Jersey without attacking, General Greene warned, I think we will regret it. People expect something from us, and our strength demands it. I am by no means for rash measures, he concluded, but we must preserve our reputation. It was a political argument aimed at restoring popular faith in George Washington and the army after the disappointments of 1777. Other officers, however, supported the contrary views of American General Charles Lee. A British veteran with considerable experience, General Lee was the Army's second-ranking officer. Competent early in the war, he became critical of George Washington during the defeats of late 1776. A British patrol had captured Lee in December, but Lee was exchanged and rejoined the Army only weeks before British General Clinton evacuated Philadelphia. Lee had little faith in Washington's regulars. Continentals, Lee warned, would prove no match for redcoat professionals. Lee argued for letting Clinton go, arguing that there was no need to risk the American army. Wouldn't it be better, Lee asked, to await French intervention while preserving American strength? Lee insisted that a Patriot victory in New Jersey would mean little, while a serious defeat could do irreversible harm. Rebel spirits had soared at news of the French alliance and the British evacuation of Philadelphia, and General Clinton wanted nothing more than to lure George Washington into a showdown fight. Clinton looked to pounce on any mistake the American general made, and General Lee wanted to avoid just such an eventuality. Beset by the council's conflicting opinions, George Washington again chose a middle course. Agreeing to reinforce the advanced troops shadowing General Clinton, Washington dispatched Brigadier Charles Scott with 1,500 Virginians to support Maxwell Morgan and the militia. These reinforcements brought Patriot strength near Clinton to some 3,500, and Washington wanted a major general in charge. When General Lee refused the command, he considered it too small. A delighted Lafayette of France took the assignment. Eager Hawks, however, notably Alexander Hamilton, General Wayne, and General Greene, then forcefully argued for a still larger reinforcement. They prevailed, and Washington sent another 1,000 men under the fire-eating General Wayne. Still, Washington was not rash. He warned Lafayette that hitting Clinton was very desirable, but told Lafayette not to exhaust his men in the scorching heat. Thus, the Hopewell, New Jersey Council had resulted in a considerable movement towards the British, although George Washington still remained conscious. But not so the impetuous Lafayette. He became utterly reckless and planned to attack the British royal troops on the morning of the 26th of June. Lafayette charged forward with inadequate supplies and poor intelligence of the enemy and moved well beyond supporting range of Washington's main army. Alexander Hamilton, serving as Lafayette's aide, feared a disaster. To everyone's relief, at the last minute, Lafayette called off his assault, his men exhausted, and his supplies nearly gone. Wisely, the commander-in-chief, George Washington, ordered Lafayette to Englishtown, 11 miles north. There, Lafayette was to meet General Lee, who, having reconsidered his initial reticence, now requested the forward command on the basis of its now considerable size. Washington had agreed with the stipulation that General Lee support Lafayette if the young Frenchman had already engaged the British. Lafayette almost had. Some of his units had come within a mile of British General Clinton's line before Lafayette ordered them back. It had been a close call. The opposing armies had reached the eve of battle. On June 27th, George Washington's main body was at Cranberry, New Jersey, about 4 miles west of General Lee's advance corps, about 4,500 at Englishtown. Including militia, the Americans numbered some 13,000. Clinton had about as many. Clinton had stayed in Freehold on the 27th of June, and if Clinton hoped for Washington or one of the rebel generals to pick a fight, Clinton was in luck. Washington sought an engagement, but how? Late on June 27th, Washington met with General Lee and his chief subordinates. Everyone later agreed that the commander-in-chief wanted the vanguard, General Lee's men, to advance early on June 28th. But Washington issued no specific orders on when, how, or even to attack. Wayne later stated that he never heard General Washington give any particular orders for the attack. Indeed, Washington was vague on exactly what he expected, and General Lee reasonably concluded that his orders were discretionary and that he was to govern his conduct according to events. Lee had Washington's promise, however, to support Lee's advance with the main army. Lee moved early on Sunday, June 28, 1778, but his advance was hesitant. He had sent Colonel William Grayson with a party of observation towards Freehold, New Jersey, but even so, intelligence on the British situation was conflicting. General Lee knew that British General Clinton's baggage was already moving, but where was Clinton's main body? At around 7:30 that morning, as Generals Lee and Wayne rode forward to reconnoiter and catch up with Grayson, they heard firing ahead. But who was engaged? It was not Grayson. The noise was from a sharp skirmish between state militia and the British Queen's American Rangers, a crack Loyalist regiment. The Rangers had come out to chase a rebel scouting party led by General von Steuben, who got cleanly away as the skirmishing flared. The Rangers scattered the militia, but backed off rather than confront another larger and strongly posted militia concentration. Thus, the opening round of the battle was an all-American affair. Patriot militia versus Tory Rangers. The end of the skirmish, however, revealed nothing of General Clinton's dispositions. General Lee hesitated to advance quickly, fearing a British attack would catch him in difficult terrain. Local militia officers warned of just such a risk. But after a wait with no solid information on British deployments, shortly after 9 that morning, an impatient General Charles Lee moved with General Wayne in the lead. Battle was joined after 10 that morning. General Lee had spotted a redcoat column marching out of Freehold and thought it was a rear guard. Could he take it? Lee quickly came up with a plan. General Wayne and supporting artillery would stay in position. He was to fix the enemy in place, while Lee swung to the left to drop behind and encircle the redcoats. He would bag the lot without risking a major battle. The plan was reasonable, and Lee put his troops in motion. With General Lee moving, however, part of General Wayne's command suddenly came under attack. While chasing some militia, the crack 16th Light Dragoons spotted and made for the battalion of Colonel Richard Butler. Warned by the fleeing militia, Butler's men swung in line, just as General von Steuben had taught him, and fired a volley at the charging British. The dragoons broke off, with several saddles emptied. First blood to the American Continentals. Colonel Butler's rebuff of the 16th turned out to be the high point of the American morning. American General Lee had run into trouble. It turned out that the rebels had encountered more than a rear guard. Instead, they were facing British Lord Cornwallis at the head of some 6,000 men, with more coming. General Clinton had spotted American General Lee's approach, and fearing an attack on his slow-moving baggage train or an effort to cut off his march to Sandy Hook, he ordered General Cornwallis to counterattack. As Cornwallis closed, General Lee's battle fell apart. The British bore down on the American right in overwhelming strength, and as General Lee considered a response, he was infuriated to find that his left had disappeared. Battalions under Brigadier Generals Charles Scott and William Maxwell, the Americans, had withdrawn. The Brigadiers had misinterpreted the movements of other Patriot units as a retreat, and they feared being cut off as the British advanced. With his left gone, and British General Cornwallis threatening, American General Lee had no alternative but to retreat, this time for real. General Wayne wanted to stay and fight the British near Freehold, but the remaining Americans were vastly outnumbered and lacked any defensible position. As the British came on, Lee conducted an orderly retrograde. Searching for ground to make a stand, Lee was at a loss until a Monmouth County militia officer pointed out Perrine's Hill. That hill was a defensible terrain overlooking the bridge across Spotwood Middlebrook and a wide bog, also called the West Morass. General Lee had crossed the bridge earlier during his advance towards Freehold, and he now directed his troops toward it with the intention of forming on the hill behind it. But General Lee never made it. At about 1 that afternoon, still on the Freehold side of the bridge, Lee met George Washington, who had come up ahead of the main army. The exhausted Major General Lee completely misread the situation. General Lee honestly expected a compliment from Washington on Lee's skillful retreat, which certainly had saved the Continental Army from probable annihilation. Instead, General Washington curtly desired to know, sir, as Lee recalled, the reason whence arises this disorder and confusion. Confounded, Lee was momentarily at a loss for words, silenced less by the question itself than by George Washington's tone of voice. The commander-in-chief, as one of Lee's aides remembered, had displayed considerable warmth. He was unmollified when Lee tried to explain the tactical situation. Washington insisted that Lee should have pushed ahead with his attack. Whatever George Washington's exact words, he was clearly annoyed to find General Lee retreating. That a stand near Freehold would have been suicidal on Lee's part made no difference now. Nothing Lee could have said in his defense would have mattered. Having in effect relieved General Lee, Washington rode forward personally to assess the situation. The George Washington-Charles Lee confrontation has become part of American folklore. Over the years, various supposed witnesses to the incident dramatically embellished the story. Lafayette and General Scott were classic examples. As old men, their accounts had George Washington in a perfect fury. The Frenchman remembered the general calling Lee a damned poltroon, while General Scott's version was astonishingly fanciful. Washington swore on that day, the old brigadier famously insisted, till the leaves shook on the trees, charming delightfully. Never did I enjoy such swearing before or since. Sir, on that memorable day, he swore like an angel from heaven. It's all nonsense. Neither man was remotely close enough to hear Washington or Lee. Scott was almost a mile away. No one made any such claim during Washington's lifetime, and even General Lee never accused Washington of profanity. General Lee's court-martial transcript told the tale. It reflected a blunt battlefield exchange between the two senior commanders of the Continental Army, an occasion dramatic enough to need no embellishment after the fact. As Washington confronted Lee, the British advance continued. Lee's troops continued struggling west, covered by gallant Continental artillery that limbered up and withdrew with the enemy only yards behind them. By now, British General Clinton had joined General Cornwallis, and the British commander-in-chief bravely but recklessly led from the front. Washington quickly recognized the gravity of the British threat. Cooling off, Washington ordered General Wayne and some 900 men into a point of woods to the right of the British approach, and Washington asked General Lee with organizing a holding action west of General Wayne's position. Washington then rode back to meet the main army, which was still coming up. He and his officers worked feverishly to organize the regiments and batteries along Perrine's Hill, the very place to which Lee had been headed. On the freehold side of Spotswood Middle Brook, General Lee formed behind a hedgerow directly in front of the British advance, some 850 yards west of American General Wayne's concealed men. The British had seen General Lee taking position, but they had not seen General Wayne scrambling into the woods. The Redcoats paid a stiff price. General Wayne's Continentals blasted the surprised First Guards at almost point-blank range as they marched by, heading for Lee. An instant response by the Guards and First Grenadiers, the pride of the British Army, and the charging 16th Light Dragoons then overran Wayne in ferocious hand-to-hand fighting. Under terrific pressure, General Wayne's remnants pulled out and made for the bridge and the safety of Perrine's Hill. The rest of the British, now breaking into a rush, made for General Lee at the hedgerow. British General Clinton led, swinging his sword and riding, as one of his junior officers recalled, like a Newmarket jockey, and shouting for his men to forget formation and go flat out for the rebels. They did, and the fighting at the hedgerow was brutal but short. Continentals and Redcoats exchanged fire only feet from each other and thrust bayonets through the fence and foliage. Lee ordered his men to fall back over the bridge only after Dragoons and Redcoats began to work around both of his flanks. It had been a gallant defense against an equally gallant assault. The British made a final stab at the retreating American militia. As the last of General Lee's men escaped, Lieutenant Colonel Henry Monckton led elements of the British 2nd Grenadiers on a charge across the bridge, while other grenadiers attempted to push across the bog and wade the stream. They were met by a withering barrage of rebel artillery fire. The Continentals had massed their largest artillery concentration of the war on Perrine's Hill, and the grenadiers didn't stand a chance as grapeshot and canister scythed them down. Colonel Monckton was mortally wounded, the highest-ranking British casualty of the day. It was over in a horrible minute, and the heaps of dead and wounded grenadiers marked the closest the British came to Washington's main line. Colonel Monckton's defeat marked a lull in the action. The rebels had consolidated their position on Perrine's Hill while Clinton pulled back to the hedgerow Lee had recently defended. A British column that had tried to flank the American left sheltered in an orchard, stalled, and pinned down by rebel artillery fire. Unknown to British General Clinton, a Continental detachment of infantry with four guns under American Nathaniel Greene was slowly working its way from George Washington's right, aiming to get in position on Clinton's left. But it would be some time before General Greene could engage. Meanwhile, both armies got what rest they could. Troops on both sides had endured a brutally hot morning and early afternoon. Combat had raged in temperatures well above 90 degrees, and humidity held clouds of smoke in the air. Heat exhaustion proved as dangerous as enemy fire and likely accounted for more casualties. It was now about 1:45 in the afternoon, and for the moment the infantry battle was over, but not the artillery fight. While the exhausted infantry looked on, rival Continental and Royal Artillery batteries slugged it out in the longest continuous cannonade of the war. Rebel gun crews re-equipped and reorganized at Valley Forge under the eye of Brigadier General Henry Knox, the American Army's capable chief of artillery, proved as good as their veteran British opponents. The opposing gunners actually fought in line of sight. For all the sound and fury, however, and for all the hot metal flung through the torrid air, neither side inflicted much damage. Almost by some unstated mutual consent, the fire lifted around 3:45 that afternoon, at which British General Clinton decided to call it a day. Convinced that Washington would not offer a decisive battle, and with his baggage train safely away, the royal commander considered it was time to pull out and head to Sandy Hook and get to New York. George Washington had other plans. Now feeling safe from any attack, the Patriot chief decided to risk some limited offensives before General Clinton could withdraw the field. He sent two light infantry battalions to clear the redcoats from the orchard on the American left. These British were withdrawing anyway, but the Patriot battalion under Colonel Joseph Cilley of New Hampshire forced them back in a sharp and skillful action. American General Wayne then sallied from Washington Center, hitting the Grenadiers at the hedgerow and provoking a determined British counterattack. Supported by deadly artillery fire from General Greene, who by now had occupied Coombs Hill overlooking the British Army left, General Wayne's command inflicted serious casualties in a brutal defensive stand on the grounds of a local parsonage. In both actions, the rebels showed discipline and grit. General Clinton now disengaged. Late in the day, General Washington dispatched another probe, but it failed to make contact before nightfall. While the rebels slept on the field and expected renewed combat on Monday, British General Clinton saw no point. He skillfully slipped away in the dark. The Americans never heard him go, and he arrived at Sandy Hook 2 days later. On July 5th, the Royal Navy began ferrying his units to safety in locations around New York, effectively ending the Monmouth campaign. The morning of June 29, 1778, found the rebels jubilant. "It is glorious for America," Colonel Israel Shreve wrote his wife Polly. "After tough fighting, the enemy was drove off the ground. In all the actions hereto, though, Colonel William Irvin exulted, the Americans never took the field, but this time they humbled the pride of the British tyrant." In near disbelief, another officer informed his wife that our little boys had bested their gigantic grenadiers. British General Clinton, of course, scoffed at all of this, noting that getting his army back to New York, he had done what he had set out to do. But that failed to register with the ecstatic American patriots. For all the rebel jubilation, Monmouth, New Jersey courthouse had been a punishing battle. Washington officially tallied 69 American patriot dead, 161 wounded, and 141 missing. But post-battle losses from wounds, heat, and disease likely extended patriot casualties to something approaching 450 to 500 killed, wounded, and missing. British General Clinton's losses totaled well in excess of 300 killed, including those who died from the heat, and considerably more were wounded. In addition, the British lost a fair number of prisoners and as many as 1,000 deserters during the march from Philadelphia. Altogether, it was a substantial loss. The battle had demonstrated Continental mettle, and it also had shown Washington at his best. Posting Generals Lee and Wayne forward to buy time had been correct, and Washington, along with Major General William Alexander, had capably organized an effective main line on Perrine's Hill. Sending Cilley and Wayne against specific targets showed initiative without risking a general engagement that could have endangered his still relatively weaker army. It was a deft tactical performance by George Washington. The general also made himself conspicuous during the fighting. Indeed, Washington's coolness as he rode the lines during the artillery barrage and then sent Cilley and Wayne forward was inspirational. According to Lafayette, the general's nobility, grace, and presence of mind were never displayed to better advantage. I do not think for my part, remembered Dr. James McHenry, Washington's military secretary, the general in one day displayed more military powers or acquired more real reputation. He gave a new turn to the action. He was always in danger, examining the enemy's maneuvers, exhorting his troops, and directing the operation of his plans. He unfolded surprising abilities which produced uncommon effects. In fact, McHenry and Lafayette spoke for many others who saw Monmouth, New Jersey, and it was one of Washington's finest hours. Monmouth also revealed, however, that the Army still had some problems. The absence of American cavalry, as General Lee's experience at the Hedgerow and General Wayne's in the Point of Woods painfully showed, left the Army vulnerable to British horse. Serious command and control deficiencies remained. If Lee had lost touch with General Scott and Maxwell, Washington was just as culpable in losing track of Lee's situation. Unaware of Lee's difficulties, Washington was slow in bringing up the main army on the 28th. Then there was the failure of Daniel Morgan to engage. Morgan had 800 men on the British left and in a position to strike, he could hear the battle, but he never received clear orders. It was a genuine blunder, and a more experienced Continental staff would have handled command and control more effectively. Yet for all these problems, the American Continentals had done well. Certainly many British thought so. The enemy were very troublesome at Monmouth, a junior British officer conceded. The rebels had left his regiment a good deal cut up. William Erskine, one of Clinton's ablest generals, reported the battle as a handsome flogging. We had not received such a one in America. Whatever it might have done better, the Continental Army had made its mark. This is Wallace Klingdienst, volunteer leader for Sun Sounds of Arizona. If you miss a program, you can get it on demand at sunsounds.org. Left click on Broadcast Info and Audio, then under Programming Links, left click on Demand Podcasts. You can now listen to Sun Sounds on your Echo Dot or other smart home device.